you came looking for how to buy art as an investment, you're in the wrong place. This is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, not the other way. I say that, though, because the art and artists that I'm going to be considering are all people of major stature that have, over the course of the 20th century, become very famous artists, and their works would be bought and sold at tremendous prices. Maybe we ought to first look at, you know, what it is to be a prophet in the 20th century. Strictly speaking, I suppose, when we look at Scripture, a prophet is one to whom God speaks and who in turn speaks God's message to the people. Now, I don't want to be presumptuous and say that that is exactly the role that these artists are fulfilling. But if we look at the sense of the prophet in the Old Testament, particularly, we find, you know, we quickly get past this simple idea that he's somebody that sees into the future, and we realize that that really isn't what prophets were doing at all. Prophets were people who were speaking to their time, and I'm using the term prophet then to refer to artists who help us to see ourselves clearly. If you think of the Old Testament prophets, that's what God sent them to do. He said, "Hey, look at yourselves. You know, this is what you guys are doing. And if you don't shape up, this may happen." He says, "Repent," and so forth. But basically, he's sending people out to just show their condition. And I think it's in that sense in which we can look at the art of our century and find out that artists are speaking to us in a very real way about our condition. Of course, art in the 20th century, too, is so diverse that we can't probably designate any artist as being a prophet in this sense either, but I have, of course, been selective. Another role of the prophet, then, was to tell it like it is, to point out evil, and we may see some things like that. Also, prophets in the Old Testament were sent sometimes to be warnings against false gods, and it's kind of interesting to look at contemporary art and say, well, is that ever, do we ever get an insight on that? What are our false gods in our time? And finally, the prophets were there to call people to repentance, to ask them to change, to turn. And I don't know whether this is what artists consciously intend, but I think when you look at some of the works of art, it is certainly finally the outcome, perhaps, of what we see. I might also say in a general way here at the outset that the 20th century artists rarely, if ever, points to Christ. He's seldom an evangelist. Now, we do have Christian artists who use visual means to portray the gospel in any number of ways. But since I said at the beginning, we are considering artists who are really in the mainstream, you know, of art history, we're not going to find people that are bearing the good news, at least not the gospel, the Christian. They're not evangelists. One final thing before I show slides. I have an alternate title for this presentation, and I know that board gets too loaded if you try to put them all up there, and this might have turned people away, so I didn't put that up there. But the alternate title would be Art You Wouldn't Want in Your Home. And you can kind of decide for yourself whether you would or wouldn't in any of these cases, or whether it's even possible. But I do hope to come back to that thought at the end as kind of a closing, so you might just keep that in mind. While you are back there by the door, could you switch out the light, please? I would appreciate that. The first image, okay, here we go. I said that the prophet enables us to see ourselves clearly. That is, I think, what we do here. If I can get this in focus, we'll see even more clearly. Okay. Dwayne Hansen is an artist who makes things out of cast resin. He actually makes casts of real people. and he makes them out of plaster or out of plastic material. He paints them with meticulous detail. He clothes them. He puts hair on them and so forth. And I'll show you another image here, the same sort. Some of you, if you were here last week, you might have seen this. You've all seen these people before, haven't you? You know, I don't know what supermarket you go to or what resorts you visit or who you looked at when you were in Chelan, but you've all seen these people before. And it really is what we Americans in the 20th century are like. And sometimes it's not at all flattering. It's so weird to be an artist and deal with seeing and talking about prophets and artists who help us see, and I'm suddenly left without a light and I can very little read my notes here. Let's go on to see what else happens. I think that we can say that when an artist says, this is what it's like, he is saying, listen, the old hearken or behold idea. And he may talk about human nature. He may talk about society and using different themes, and we're going to consider some of those now. This painting is one that, if you have been interested in art at all, very likely you have seen it reproduced in a book or something. And it's kind of the ultimate essence of an attitude. This goes really just prior to the 20th century, but it's close enough that I consider it with this topic. I would like, by the way, to invite you to discuss what you see and to share your ideas with me and with each other. And so I'm going to let you at any time raise your hand or just say what you want, because very often people see things that I don't. And let me just start with this slide by asking you, what do you get out of it? What kind of feeling is conveyed to you? What kind of impression? Horror or connection with death? Is that correct? Yeah, okay. All right. Despair and terror. All right. Any others? Oh, okay. Were you there?
No.
Okay. One of the things that we learn about our perception and about looking at art or anything else is that we always view through our own experiences. And we can't help but interpret things through our own experience and through our present time. Now, of course, this was written, this was painted probably 75, 80 years prior to that. But there must be something in that experience that is applicable here. Just looking at those other words, despair, death, and so forth, they're certainly related probably to the specific that you mentioned with Vietnam. Okay, the kind of anxiety or despair, it's called the scream. And I kind of think that this painting is about that primal scream that just comes welling from the depths of people and is inescapable. They have to shout it out. Some have looked at the bridge and seen a kind of a metaphor for life, the bridge between life and death. But it perhaps sums up in a single image the kind of feeling that has been, at least in part in the 20th century, pervasive among a number of people, the kind of anxiety and lostness that people have felt. We had a lot of writers and so forth doing that earlier in the century. The angst, the feelings of particularly alienation. A lot of our century, earlier on, writers and so forth are dealing with being alone. Here, I think, another painting by the same artist, Munch. It's on the surface of it, a gentle scene of three young girls standing on a bridge in a little village under a bright sky, looking over the edge of the bridge into the water. And yet, the way the artist has composed this, the shadow, or rather the reflection of that tree in the water, it seems to me becomes kind of a infinite depth you know, looking into this black hole, perhaps, of despair or emptiness. I think that those feelings were sort of part and parcel of Edvard Munch, who was a Norwegian. I know there are a lot of people of Norwegian extraction back here. This is also Munch, and there is something. Well, what do you feel about this? What particular something very anonymous about looking at them? Okay. How do those eyes and faces almost look? They almost look like
ghosts,
corpses, skulls, lost. Okay. He was not, by the way. But he did have this kind of insight, I think, on life. He was a very brooding man, probably. But we hear a lot about the faceless crowd, right? And each face is the same. It is anonymous, as you said. There is no identity. There is no individual identity among these people, is there? James Ensor, another Scandinavian of the same period, did painting after painting where all his faces had masks, where you think that there must be something human and real hidden behind those masks that people are wearing. And again, I think throughout the 20th century, we have heard writers and so forth giving us imagery of wearing a mask, not knowing our full identity. I think in the last 20 years, we have heard so many ways of getting in touch with ourselves, who we are, answering some of these questions that were posed with such depth and clarity by the artists and writers of the early part of the century that we're looking at here. Where here at Holden Village, we were after a kind of community, and what we were looking at here is people that are so totally separate. They haven't established community. And that's why it's kind of good for us in this setting, I think, to see these images, because we see and we can empathize with people who can't make connections. And we see all over again the value of being able to do that. And that is the prophet speaking to us, enabling us to see the need. This image by Edvard Munch, it seems to me, can you see that face, that little dim face way down at the bottom there? You see that? Probably behind the candle for some of you. But it's a ghostly face that is... Oh, where do you see that? Where do you see that echoed in the house? They almost look like eyes, don't they? Yeah. Yeah, that is a good connection. That's a good insight, particularly since you know, throughout history, people have seen the human eye as a window to the person or to the window to the soul, and this one is vacant. That's interesting. It's a good point. Very good insight. But look at the way he's composed this picture. Look at the separation. We're not dealing here just with the separation between person and person, but this man is separated even from the world of things. You know, there's a total alienation from not only people, but even from the world of things. And you get the idea that these people were feeling alienated, certainly from the ground of being, from God, or anything other, you know, on which to stand or to fill them. So these people have showed us what death and mourning are like. This is an American artist, Ivan Albright, who exaggerates the mortal. His flesh that he paints is always a little disgusting. A little disgusting. It's a lot disgusting. It's always on the way, like meat that's a little stale and getting green. You know, it's just a little bit like that. But he takes this mortality and he just brings it into full focus. I'll show you a little bit close up of this same figure. You know what he calls this? You know what the title of this is? And God created man in his own image. I don't know what Ivan Albright's theology was, but it really gets you to sit up and take notice, doesn't it? He has always these poignant titles. There's another very famous painting of a woman powdering herself in front of a mirror, and she looks as bad as this person. He calls it, into the world came a soul named Ida. He really empathizes with these people, but he does emphasize our mortality. Pardon me? This was painted, just guessing, I would say in the 30s. In the 30s, 1930s. In the 40s, there was a movie made, Hollywood made a movie of the picture of Dorian Gray. You know the novel where this man makes a pact with the devil, and he says, if you give me my youth, what happens is there's a painting of him in the attic that gets old while he remains as eternal youth. And so they got this artist to do the changing, decaying, aging person. Well, let's go on. That's a little much. Well, then we get to Picasso. Maybe that's a little much, too. Whereas the last man sort of exaggerated the intricacies of the detail of the flesh in order to make his point, Picasso simply distorts the whole figure in all of its parts, you know, so that the parts of the figure literally cry out, often in pain. It would be a mistake, however, to look at every Picasso, even with its distortion, and think that it's some sort of a twisting for the sake of pain or the gruesome. It's not. It just can't always be interpreted that way. But I think something like this, again, gets at this kind of despair, and it is so out of joint that it is rather painful. I'm going to stop occasionally in case you want to throw in a comment. This is Picasso's most famous work, and many of you will know it. It's the Guernica. I just had to show it because it is such a landmark in terms of prophecy, in showing us, in this case, the brutality of war, where fine art was used as a means of crying out. In this case, it was an incident that happened in the late 1930s in the Spanish Civil War, where a little town, a Basque town in northern Spain, was simply wiped out for bombing practice. You know, he was in Franco and his cohorts just simply wiped it out. And Picasso, who had by then left Spain, vowed never to return until Franco left. Well, anyway, he painted this large painting. There's a mother with her dead child over here, with all of the pain we heard about in Bible class this morning, the innocents being killed under Herod and so forth. If you can see this figure over way in the left, there's a bull, a kind of symbol for not only violence, but also kind of a life force on a mythic level. There's all kinds of anguished figures, flaming houses, and kind of a arm holding a lantern out that may or may not be lit. And Picasso's symbolism of the light bulb that looks like an eye overall, we really don't know. If he were a Christian, we might say it were a symbol for God, but he wasn't. So anyway, it's a light, perhaps hope there. So we have a lot of people, you know, in the 20th century who gave us images of affliction and cruelty, and this particular artist, Rico Lebrun, did a series, for instance, on the Buchenwald, the Nazi war camp. We're just, you know, a few weeks ago, we heard a lot of talk about the Holocaust and so forth, and there have been artists that have done images related to this. They're not pretty, but they help us to see and to understand and to feel, you know, if we weren't there, to get in touch with things. I think that here at Holden we are interested in dealing with real issues and bringing answers to them, at least finding ways of dealing with social issues. And the artists have had some things to give us insight into conditions. This is by Mauricio Lozansky, who did a series of very large drawings. It was called the Nazi drawings. And I don't know how well you can make this out. It's a very subtle drawing. The slide is not bad, but it's a very subtle drawing. Down at the bottom, you have a lot of bodies of people, largely infants and children. And again, this is referring to the Nazi Holocaust. And what he is showing you in the background here, above it, are clerics, a priest and a bishop, or a cardinal, I don't know which. He is saying something about the inability or the unwillingness of the church and the clerics at that time to come forward and make a very strong statement to protect these people or come out against what was happening under those social circumstances. If we look around, we can find images that are very, very revealing. There's a hand in the back.
Is that a print or a drawing?
It is a drawing. It's about a 6-foot high drawing on paper, just graphite and stuff. Well, I'm at Concordia. One of my jobs is to be in charge of the art gallery, and this last September I organized an exhibition called The Art of the Cartoon. What I'm saying is your premise of saying that, you may not be saying that cartoons are not art, but you're saying that a different kind of art, right? That would get very much into how one defines art. And maybe you are saying that art ought to be more universal. Is that possible? If I didn't feel a little bit in agreement with you, I would find it easier to answer your question. To be perfectly honest with you. But I do think that this has a great deal it has more emotional depth than the kind of political cartoonist that you're thinking. It's not either coming from humor. Now, I know Stayskull and, not Stayskull, but McNally and Paul Conrad and so forth, they're serious, but there is always that biting humor, which I don't find here. That would be one distinction I would make. And then I think that his intent here, and even the style of his drawing, the style of his composition, has more depth than those other things. But I do hear what you're saying. And, I'm not so sure that Lozansky, in terms of art, is the greatest artist. But he is making a very, very moving image here. And I'm putting it in this context to show a variety of kinds of images where artists have shown us ourselves. Maybe I should have shown you some political cartoons and said, these guys are also prophets. But I think arguing the merits of whether this is good or bad art, it falls a little outside the scope of what we can do here. I see another hand there, yeah. He's a good draftsman. He's a very excellent draftsman. I think what I hear you two are talking about different things, though. One is talking about the content and one is talking about the form. The two things we talk about in art. I'm not going to attempt to try to get into aesthetics per se, great art, not so good. I just beyond the scope. One more thing over there. Uniforms can hide. Again, anonymity can be used to create an image that maybe isn't really underneath it, too. Okay. I won't spend too much time on this because it's much the same kind of image as the last, and I think there are some other kinds of things that we can deal with further on. But here is, for instance, this is called The Survivor, and even though it was done at toward the end of World War II, I think we could see it probably as a rather powerful image for a nuclear holocaust or anything else. Do you feel the same way about this painting, by the way? I'm put you on the spot. I didn't mean to do that. One thing that... Okay. War is more universal than the specific church Nazi thing, perhaps. The other thing, I think all of these, you have to realize, are pretty obvious. In terms of art critics, for a long time in the 20th century, this kind of art was not considered very highly at all, because it is so blatantly emotional. And I thought maybe that's what you were getting at, but that could be an issue for someone. Yeah, I think what you're saying is important. I believe very strongly in the power of metaphor, you know, that this is that. And because we're looking at it in a different medium or a transformed state or a new image, it illumines us and it illumines the original one, rather than just literally showing it to us. Yeah, I think that's what art can, and I won't say should, but great art can do that. It can. But I think even a specific one like that early shopper in the shopping cart, it kind of it's a specific that sort of summarizes so many, you know. Well, does it get beyond? Okay, I do want to get beyond. This is now a sort of social satire. This was done during the Second World War II in Germany, or before that. It was earlier than that, where it's sort of an image of the powers that be. And they are made to seem very ludicrous. Probably the bankers and the military people, all of the good people in society with position and power and authority and vested interests and so forth, and they're made to seem quite ridiculous. Either their heads are broken open and they're shown to have nothing but stuffing of steel parts inside, or one has an upturned teacup over his head and so forth. You know, they're really brought down to size and they're made to seem ridiculous. And this is a painting by George Grosz. In a sense, it is a political cartoon. You know, there have been some painters that painted with oil on canvas that did things along those lines. I think that's what we find. Here's another one. Gropper, what was his name? I forgot his first name. Where, you know, it's showing us what it's like a typical day in the Senate. One guy, a lot of bombast, and everybody else is sleeping or reading the paper. And in this case, it's using a satire. It's using a sense of humor, almost as though a political cartoonist does it. But I do want to get on to some other kinds of things. I couldn't help but put this one in because we are in a mining camp, and Ben Shawn at one time was doing some socially oriented issue kinds of things where what happens to the family, what happens to the women and children when men go off to the mine and may or may not come back. And he was saying some things about the social system at the time that would allow, because of carelessness or greed, people to not be protected as well as they might when they went into mines and so forth. So we do have these kinds of social issues treated. This is by that same artist that did the shopper with the cart. It's called The Bowery Bums. And most of us, if we're in New York City or something, we really try very hard not to look at these people. We try very hard to avoid panhandlers, and let alone the drunks in the stoops along the store and so forth. And yet, art enables us, unfortunately, to look at things very clearly. And when this is full three-dimensional, full-size figures, and you have to confront the reality when you look at this kind of thing. I'm going to go. Oh, there are Dwayne Hansen sculptures in museums all over the place. I have seen a one-man show, a whole museum full of his things, but where any one thing is, I couldn't tell you. I just don't know. Here's Edward Keenholz. If you want to see an image of institutionalization in the 20th century, this is about a mental hospital. It's not a pretty sight, but when he did this, you know, it's an anguished cry against what happens to. And if you notice, the figure up above is the same image as the one down below. It's as if this man has nothing to think about but himself. It becomes another image of himself. Or maybe it's saying that everyone there is in the same condition or treated the same or whatnot. Yes, please. No, this is a different person. He does not cast from figure. He creates these. This is someone else. No. Yeah, reassuring. He also sometimes, like here, uses fish bowls for faces as this kind of emptiness and so forth. But he does use real beds, real bedpans, and things like that. You know, so it's disquieting, to say the least. It's moving. It's terrifying. It's really terrifying to approach something like that. There are other terrifying images of what it is like in the anonymous city. George Tooker did things like this. The bureaucracy. The bureaucracy involving any government impersonal offices and so forth, and the silence, the waiting, the awful, disquieting, dispirited kinds of things. I'm going to skip that just for the sake of time. We in our time right now have a renewed interest in expressionism, which was came out of back 1920s or so, particularly among Europeans and Germans, where they distort form and color for emotional effect. This one is very recent, though. This is probably about four years ago only. And I'm showing it to you because it's called The Lady Killer. And I think it probably communicates a lot about some of the feelings of the abuse of women in society today, the savagery done to them, and so on. Quite disturbing. What? It's a Dutch artist. I've forgotten his name. I could look it up later for you if you want, but I'm not even familiar with him. We saw this the other day in one of my presentations. It's, you know, what happens when you see people, as Leger did, relating them to machine-made parts. I don't know, in this case, whether it's a negative comment or whether it's kind of celebrating people in the machine age. I think you could read some of these things either way. But the point is, 50, 60 years ago, Leger found a way to visually help us to see what it's like to be human in a machine age. We're past that. We're in the information age. But maybe it was more poignant or more meaningful then. But this is kind of, I'm showing you several images of women here, how they are treated or mistreated. And again, you can look at this as the artist making the comment, isn't this awful that women are treated in this kind of mechanistic way? Is he saying, is he a part of the problem or part of the solution? I think you could look at it either way, and I'm not so sure. Now, here's Elizabeth Taylor. I said that one of the questions is, who are our gods? If the prophet is there to point out and warn us against false gods, it seems we have a lot of people showing us who the gods of our time are, particularly if we go back 15, 20 years to what we called pop art. Remember pop art? Where they took things from the world of popular culture. That's where they got its name, comic strips, products on supermarket shelves, newspaper, magazine advertisements, billboards, that sort of thing. And that became the sum and substance, in fact, the subject matter of their art, this popular culture. And so famous Andy Warhol would take somebody like Elizabeth Taylor, and she becomes an icon in the 20th century. You know, she is kind of the goddess, and all of her type are sort of the goddess for much of American people, it seems. Or other people, he's dealt with Mao, Mick Jagger, Muhammad Ali, and he distorts their color and so forth in unusual ways. But he's always dealing with famous people, with celebrities, with strong media types. And I don't know what Andy Warhol ever has in mind. Nobody does. He never comments. And you don't know whether he is celebrating these people, whether he is making some sort of negative comment about it, or whether he's just saying, that's the way it is. You know, we really don't know. But other pop artists, like Wesselman, again, I think that he treats, in this case, woman as an object. Like every other object in his painting. He called them the Great American Nude Series. And you don't really know whether he's for it or against it. or whether it's just that it's there. That's the way things are. If that's the case, I think that this is the way he is being a prophet. He's not giving solutions, and I don't think any of these artists are giving solutions, but they're just saying that's the way they are. See? Or what are our gods? Our appliances? Is our the great God comfort our God? You know? Oldenburg made these huge appliances and other things like French fries. Think about that, French fries. Hamburgers, big hamburgers, floor size, as big as several of these chairs, stuffed and soft. And are they our gods? Well, Holden Village gives us a time to sort of reconsider and stand back and see what our gods really are. Oh, that tumbles from the ceiling. That's probably 10 feet tall, something like that, made out of soft plastic, at least 10 feet tall. He went even bigger than that. This is a little drawing. But he designs huge monuments. He takes things like a clothespin or a teddy bear or a screwdriver or a screw, and he proposes enormous monuments, like maybe this one would cross the Thames River in London or something like that, see? You remember the old Colossus of Rhodes? It was this big bronze human figure that with one foot on one side of the shore and the other foot on a place out in the bay. Well, he proposes things like that. And what does he do when he makes them so gigantic? What are our gods, you see? Are they our mechanical contraptions, our computers, or whatever? This artist took something as disposable as a beer can and made it out of bronze and painted it. Now, what kind of comment is it to make it permanent like that? Impermanence. We have people that build obsolescence into the manufacture of goods. You know, there is such a thing as built-in obsolescence. How does an artist point that out? Tingley made sculptures that moved. They were motorized. And like this one, it spun around, they clatter and clang and make all kinds of noise. Back in the 50s, he was doing this. One of his most famous work, I suppose, he built this enormous structure, motorized and so forth, in the courtyard of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, you know, Museum of Modern Art in New York, where they always have black tie openings and so forth. So, had a black tie opening for this. People were invited to come, Tingley's latest work. And what did he do? He turned it on. This whole thing began grinding and clattering and moving. And what do you think happened? It didn't quit. Well, it quit, yes, but not until it had destroyed itself. He designed a machine so that once he put it into motion, it would proceed to destroy itself. Is that a comment on our time? Nobody understood it, but it was pretty crazy. I only just crazy artists and pretty funny or something. But you think about that as an apt symbol for our time. Building something at great laborious effort and so forth that destroys itself. You can find all kinds of parallels with that without trying very hard at all. I couldn't help but show you a couple of surrealist things like this that call reality into question. Last week I presented something on what is reality, and I didn't get around to showing this, but I had to. Did any of you hear Gary Bornstein's talk this morning? The new physics, you know, things aren't what they seem anymore. And even on the level of electrons and protons and so forth, we might think we know what they are, but as soon as we turn around, they become something else. And the same thing is happening with this painting. It drives you mad because you look at it from one perspective and it's one thing and it looks perfectly right, and you shift to another tree and it's, oh, all over again. Space and form are constantly shifting back and forth. Nothing is stable. The center does not hold. And you have to find somehow some way of resolving this. And isn't that like our perception at this point in time in the 20th century, that nothing is that clear-cut? Questions we're talking about here at Holden. Issues, things that don't resolve themselves easily. Well, I'm not going to have time for that. I'll show you this one, though, because Gary Bornstein has been talking quite a bit about relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity. And this painting from about 40, 50 years ago is a kind of a wonderful visual statement on relativity. Is this a big rose in a little room, or is it a normal-sized rose in a... No. Is it a In a small room. Good, thank you. Okay? It depends on your point of view, doesn't it? Nothing is really fixed anymore. Everything is relative. And this image sort of wittily shows us that. One more thing I want to go to, and we'll sort of quit here then as time is getting on. But Rauschenberg, Robert Rauschenberg, is probably the most famous American artist today. He never presents answers that I can see. You look at his images and you always wonder, well, why does he have this diagram of a box with a couple of military helicopters with a Rubens portrait of Venus with an eagle plus a city street? You know, why does he do this? And he doesn't provide us any answers. It seems to me that what he is saying to us is that we have to make our own connections. We have to find our own meanings. We have to do it in life. When you're back down there out in the real world and you're constantly bombarded by newspaper images, television images, the stuff that's written on your cereal box in the morning, the people you run into at work, the scripture you read at night, you have to put those things together. Nobody does it for you. And people can be quite disquieted, I think, by Rauschenberg for giving us just this mashing together of disconnected images. Art traditionally has been there to give us a nice, reasonably ordered picture that we can grasp and comprehend, and the artist knows beforehand what he's doing. Rauschenberg says, that's not the way things are. That's not how we perceive things. We have to make our own meanings. Well, I'm going to stop there. Do you have any other comments or questions you want to ask at this point? I can't even see the clock to know exactly. Is it 10 till? We probably have 5 minutes. 10 till. We could probably take at the most 5 minutes then if you want to for some further discussion. All right, let me go back to that then. I said I would come back to that as a way of kind of establishing closure. Art that you wouldn't... Yeah. Okay, I said that my subtitle for this was Art You Wouldn't Want in Your Home. And he wanted me to get back to that or said that he agrees. That's what he said. All right. Artists... at least not all of them, and this is an important point I want to make. Not all artists paint things for our walls. Okay? They paint things for our eyes, in our hearts, in our understanding, in our minds, in our souls. They don't paint things for our walls. So it's one thing that many people... I see people coming into an art gallery, as I say, I see them in ours at the college, And faculty members, it's really disturbing. They come in and they look at the show, they just go around the whole thing, well, I wouldn't want that in my home, I don't want that, I wouldn't want that, I wouldn't want that, and then they walk out again. Nobody's asking, least of all the artists, to have it in their home, see? All that you take is the opportunity to look and grow, and then you make the connections and find the answers for yourself. But I want to share this with you. That I don't see any reason not to have serious art in one's home. Maybe you can't find any one specific thing here. I have something by Robert Rauschenberg in my home, for instance. It's a print, multiple. But the point, I just wanted to leave you with this story. We once had a show of work by Watanabe. Some of you know this Japanese Christian artist, Sadao Watanabe. And one of his images was of Christ and the raising of Lazarus. Lazarus was a mummy all wrapped in white strips, you know, looking very mummy-like and stiff, and Christ was there. And we had a recently widowed woman who wanted to buy that image for her home. And I thought, that's wonderful. This wonderful symbol of resurrection and the power of God to come in to life, you know. And I'm sure she must have somehow related that to the loss of her husband and her hope in the resurrection. And you know her daughter, who has a college degree and teaches at a college and so forth, she talked her mother out of buying that picture. She said, oh, mother, you wouldn't want that picture in your living room? And I was so disappointed, you know? And that this woman couldn't have had, sure, it had Lazarus, but it had the Savior. It had the symbol of hope. And maybe we ought to live with things that are of serious nature. Maybe not everything in our home should be, the prettiest flowers that we can have. I'm not so sure that we can live with these things. But I would just say that don't overlook the good power of serious things. And let me just say this. I have to say this. These artists are not negative, even though what I happen to choose to show tonight are very negative images. You have to remember, every time a work of art is created, it is saying, yes, yes, yes.